Chapter 22 in the Life Divine, Rebirth in Other Worlds, Karma, the Soul, and Immortality. We began it a few weeks ago, and tonight we conclude the chapter. He began with citations from several Upanishads, and one from the Rig Veda, all of them speaking to the passage of the secret soul behind our personality. As it moves up the chain through and after its experience in the world to what is not a final resting place, but itself a temporary birth, B-E-R-T-H, which leads to another birth, B-I-R-T-H. The soul is not extinguished by death, but uses death as it uses karma as a machinery for its exploration of the universe. The universe is a real being, a field of becoming, drawn from a real being. And the soul is too a real being, a conscious individual, a droplet of that supreme bliss, that ananda, which was the original motive power of the worlds. So this drop of bliss, the soul, is what persists and uses all the experiences available in the cosmos to grow. And this idea that it is chained to a single personality, a sort of formal structure drawn from the physical base, enlivened by this particular stream of pranic practice, a pattern, and visited by occasional thoughts, all of a certain kind of preoccupation, must be the field and scope of what is the soul, is preposterous. And Sri Aurobindo has been demolishing this argument in recent pages. Yes, there is a vehicle. The vehicle is a body, a life, and a mind at this point. And when we quit the body, we continue on to a life plane. We continue from there on to a mind plane. But what is deposited there is not the soul stuff, but rather those elements that answer to that kingdom. The soul continues to its own resting place. And rebirth occurs when that soul peers out from that resting place and says, let me recommence my work. Let me take up my mission again upon the earth. And then it comes again. So Sri Aurobindo is acknowledging that there are stages and stages through which the being passes en route to that resting place, and a return from that resting place is natural and inevitable, because how in the world could we exhaust all the cosmic possibilities for the span of a single human life? We cannot. And our purpose upon Earth is to explore for the cosmos all of its richness. So, can we remember our past births? Do we simply file everything that we've experienced into vaults which are kept secretly in the back, in a storehouse? Or are they accessible to us? Sri Aurobindo has been arguing that indeed they are experiences and summations of experiences and powers which we have now mastered, which can in some way be potently available to us again. But we are not chained to them because we have much more to do, nor should we be chained to any one personality type that we've experienced. Why must we always be the leader of the world? Can we not be a cobbler? Can we not take up anything which draws the soul's attention and have experience in that too, so that we can have in ourselves a compendium of the vast, to borrow Sri Aurobindo's phrase from Savitri. So, were we to carry all of that forward in our active memory, we'd be choked to death. And so now, he takes up this idea of what it is that the memory of the past means to us. The purpose of rebirth is to return us so that we can continue this eon-long mission to explore the cosmos and reintegrate it with its origin that happens in us, in our conscious being. It's only then that it gets extended into nature more widely. It must happen within us first. So, now he'll discuss why we don't commonly recall our past lives. It becomes at once evident that in this plan of rebirth, the false importance which our mind attaches to the memory of past lives disappears altogether. If indeed rebirth were governed by a system of rewards and punishments, if life's whole intention were to teach the embodied spirit to be good and moral, supposing that that is the intention in the dispensation of karma, and it is not what it looks like in this presentation of it, a mechanical law of recompense and retribution without any reformatory meaning or purpose, then there is evidently a great stupidity and injustice in denying to the mind in its new incarnation all memory of its past births and actions. For it deprives the reborn being of all chance to realize why he is rewarded or punished, or to get any advantage from the lesson of the profitableness of virtue and the unprofitableness of sin vouchsafed to him or inflicted on him. So simply put, if the purpose of rebirth is for us to have learned from our past errors, then we should remember what we did. If it's blocked from our consciousness, why? Even, he says, since life seems often to teach the opposite lesson, for he sees the good suffer for their goodness and the wicked prosper by their wickedness, he is rather likely to conclude in this perverse sense, because he has not the memory of an assured and constant result of experience, which would show him that the suffering of the good man was due to his past wickedness, and the prosperity of the sinner due to the splendor of his past virtues, so that virtue is the best policy in the long run for any reasonable and prudent soul entering into this dispensation of nature. It might be said that the psychic being within remembers, but such a secret memory would seem to have little effect or value on the surface. Or it may be said that it realizes what has happened and learns its lesson when it reviews and assimilates its experiences after issuing from the body. But this intermittent memory does not very apparently help in the next birth, for most of us persist in sin and error and show no tangible signs of having profited by the teaching of our past experience. So, yes, he has noted here that the psychic being within remembers. This is not pertinent to the main argument of this common view which he's presenting at this point. His own argument comes later, as is often true with a life divine. But if a constant development of being by a developing cosmic experience is the meaning and the building of a new personality and a new birth is the method, then any persistent or complete memory of the past life or lives might be a chain and a serious obstacle. It would be a force for prolonging the old temperament, character, preoccupations, and a tremendous burden hampering the free development of the new personality and its formulation of new experience. There's a lot packed in here. The constant development of a being, which is presumably the conscious being, Chit Shakti, Sat Chit Ananda, condensed into individual form, is this. Constantly developing in the development of the universe through a cosmos which is also developing. Back to the Isha Upanishad, the small universe moving in the larger moving universe. Key word here too, cosmic experience. Remember that for Sri Aurobindo, experience is the key word, why the soul comes here, why it leaves the unity of the sublime supernals above, and why it comes here into apparent darkness and division is for experience. How does it finally validate whether its experience is good or not? How does it know? It knows, again, through experience. Not through the summation of sensory data and the logical dissertations that the mind undertakes. That is a vapid, inaccurate knowledge. That is not real knowledge. Sri Aurobindo notes always that it is the experience of the deepest soul with the widest vision that has the truest understanding of things. Experience comes from a word which in Latin is experire, to try out, to experiment, to learn through acquaintance by trial, and through that succession of experiments to arrive at wisdom. Cosmos. That great word, Sri Aurobindo, the Greek scholar. Cosmos is ordered universe. It is God-ordained ordered universe upon what would otherwise be chaos. It is to take what is dark and unformed and turn it into something beautiful, because it's from the word kosmein, in Greek, to adorn. So it takes this being and adorns it with order. So the cosmos is beautiful order. Our experience in the cosmos is to discover the innate and the hidden beauty and divinity within it. And since we are a microcosm of that cosmos in ourselves, to know the cosmos to its very roots, to its very soul base in spirit, and to know our own self to its very roots and soul base within us. So I think I'll read that again. But if a constant development of being by a developing cosmic experience is the meaning, and the building of a new personality and a new birth is the method, then any persistent or complete memory of the past life or lives might be a chain and a serious obstacle. It would be a force for prolonging the old temperament, character, preoccupations, and a tremendous burden hampering the free development of the new personality and its formulation of new experience. We bother to come back to the world. Why would we want to be chained to experiences and personalities that we've already been through? To simply repeat them endlessly? No. Something new. Something farther. Let's go. A clear and detailed memory of past loves, hatreds, rancors, attachments, connections would be equally a stupendous inconvenience. For it would bind the reborn being to a useless repetition or a compulsory continuation of his surface past and stand heavily in the way of his bringing out new possibilities from the depths of the spirit. If indeed a mental learning of things were the heart of the matter, if that were the process of our development, memory would have a great importance. But what happens is a growth of the soul personality and a growth of the nature by an assimilation into our substance of being, a creative and effective absorption of the essential results of past energies. In this process, conscious memory is of no importance. He's saying that this assimilation occurs without active mentation. It goes on behind the scenes. It's digested behind in the other hidden parts of our nature. As the tree grows by a subconscient or inconscient assimilation of action of sun and rain and wind and absorption of earth elements, so the being grows by a subliminal or intraconscient assimilation and absorption of its results of past becoming and an output of potentialities of future becoming, intraconscient meaning within the conscious being. The law that deprives us of the memory of past lives is a law of the cosmic wisdom and serves, not disserves, its evolutionary purpose. It is then the intention of a guiding secret nature that we are erased from past memories when we come back. It is not active in the forefront. So now he continues in this next paragraph. The absence of any memory of past existences is wrongly and very ignorantly taken as a disproof of the actuality of rebirth. For if even in this life it is difficult to keep all the memories of our past, if they often fade into the background or fade out altogether, if no recollection remains of our infancy, and yet with all this hiatus of memory we can grow and be, if the mind is even capable of total loss of memory of past events and its own identity, and yet it is the same being who is there, and the lost memory can one day be recovered, it is evident that so radical a change as a transition to other worlds, followed by new birth in a new body, ought normally to obliterate altogether the surface or mental memory. And yet, that would not annul the identity of the soul or the growth of the nature. So, we commonly forget things. What did you eat for breakfast typically in the second grade? You won't remember that. You might remember it, and then, there's a moment. But your active continuance in this life doesn't require. So it isn't the active memory that is so important to the soul. Something else is. The identity of the soul persists, whether the memory is there at the fingertips or not. This obliteration, he writes, of the surface mental memory is all the more certain and quite inevitable if there is a new personality of the same being and a new instrumentation which takes the place of the old, a new mind, a new life, a new body. The new brain cannot be expected to carry in itself the images held by the old brain. The new life or mind cannot be summoned to keep the deleted impressions of the old mind and life that have been dissolved and exist no more. There is, no doubt, the subliminal being which may remember, since it does not suffer from the disabilities of the surface. But the surface mind is cut off from the subliminal memory, which alone might retain some clear recollection or distinct impression of past lives. How much we need to be in communion with the subliminal being, and how rare is it? We have visitations from the subliminal nature, but we don't have active commerce with it, at least in normal humanity. And here we're discussing why a normal person doesn't remember past lives, even though if he were able to penetrate and be in communion with a subliminal being, that past information may be there substantially ready for his perusal. He continues now, this separation is necessary because the new personality has to be built up on the surface without conscious reference to what is within. As with all the rest of the superficial being, so our surface personality too is indeed formed by an action from within, but of that action it is not conscious. It seems to itself to be self-formed or ready-made or formed by some ill-understood action of universal nature. So we don't understand how the secret self is forming this. We have an imperfect understanding. And yet, fragmentary recollections of past births do sometimes remain, in spite of these almost insuperable obstacles. There are even a very few cases of astonishingly exact and full memory in the child mind. Finally, at a certain stage of development of the being, when the inner begins to predominate over the outer and come to the front, past life memory does sometimes begin to emerge as if from some submerged layer, but more readily in the shape of a perception of the stuff and power of past personalities that are effective in the composition of the being in the present life than in any precise and accurate detail of event and circumstance. Although this too can recur in parts or be recovered by concentration from the subliminal vision, from some secret memory, or from our inner conscious substance. But this detailed memory is of minor importance to nature in her normal work, and she makes small or no provision for it. It is the shaping of the future evolution of the being with which she is concerned. The past is put back, kept behind the veil, and used only as an occult source of materials for the present and the future. So yes, there are occasions where we might, especially in the first few years of our life, still have access to previous life memories. And fortunately, with time that goes, as the personality begins to develop and build and focus on the immediacy of its environment and what its work is meant to do, it loses contact with that and it fades into the background. It remains effectively available to a subliminal being which is capable of mastering that process of rediscovery. But it isn't the first business, which is to move on with this life. He continues, this conception of the person and personality, if accepted, must modify at the same time our current ideas about the immortality of the soul. For normally, when we insist on the soul's undying existence, what is meant is the survival after death of a definite, unchanging personality, which was and will always remain the same throughout eternity. So this is our superficial view. It is the very imperfect superficial eye of the moment, evidently regarded by nature as a temporary form and not worth preservation, for which we demand this stupendous right to survival and immortality. But the demand is extravagant and cannot be conceded. The eye of the moment can only merit survival if it consents to change, to be no longer itself but something else, greater, better, more luminous in knowledge, more molded in the image of the eternal inner beauty, more and more progressive towards the divinity of the secret spirit. So the personality is normally a term-limited individual. It is that secret spirit or divinity of self in us which is imperishable because it is unborn and eternal. The psychic entity within, its representative, the spiritual individual in us, is the person that we are. But the I of this moment, the I of this life, is only a formation, a temporary personality of this inner person. It is one step of the many steps of our evolutionary change, and it serves its true purpose only when we pass beyond it to a farther step, leading nearer to a higher degree of consciousness and being. It is the inner person that survives death, even as it pre-exists before birth. For this constant survival is a rendering of the eternity of our timeless spirit into the terms of time. So there's a great deal in the second half of that paragraph. The secret spirit or divinity of self, the psychic entity within, the spiritual individual. So, there is a self. It is the self of this supreme conscious being whose nature is delight that we call Satchit-Ananda. It is not merely a transcendent, still, imperishable, stainless existence. It can individuate itself. It becomes universal. And the individual is an aspect of the universal. And that is as the eternal self. What is eternal self? Exhibits itself in time as the immortal soul, evolving and developing from spark to flame to fire as it grows in power and experience. It becomes one with the cosmos it explores. It is that psychic being, that soul stuff, expressive of this spiritual reality that is the true core of our being. So above, a self, an Atman, an individual aspect of that Atman, the Jivatman, a radiant representation of that Jivatman here, moving in time, the psychic being, Chaitya Purusha, which is our real being. So when he uses these terms compressed like this, we pause to take a moment to unpack it all. So again, it is this Purusha, this person, which survives, and the personality is discarded. The form of the personality is discarded. What was essential or substantial in it is kept in storage, you might say, in the subliminal. Now, forward. What our normal demand of survival asks for is a similar survival for our mind, our life, even our body. The dogma of the resurrection of the body attests to this last demand, even as it has been the root of the age-long effort of man to discover the elixir of immortality or any means, magical, alchemic, or scientific, to conquer physically the death of the body. So we want immortality for the outer shell of the being that we commonly know and identify with. But this aspiration, he writes, could only succeed if the mind, life, or body could put on something of the immortality and divinity of the indwelling spirit. There are certain circumstances in which the survival of the outer mental personality, representative of the inner mental Purusha, could be possible. It could happen if our mental being came to be so powerfully individualized on the surface and so much one with the inner mind and inner mental Purusha, and at the same time so open plastically to the progressive action of the infinite, that the soul no longer needed to dissolve the old form of mind and create a new one in order to progress. Look at the stiff demands for this. But this is what yoga leads us to. The practice of yoga leads us to perfectly individualize a mental exponent of our soul being, a manomaya purusha, which is conscious and flexible and capable of endless change, if that is what is demanded by the soul, so that it can accompany it on its immortal adventures. Then, this mental being, this manomaya purusha, this aspect of our person, in a sense, is melded, identified with that psychic being, and can persist. That's for the mind level. Now, he moves on. A similar individualization, integration, and openness of the vital being on the surface would alone make possible a similar survival of the life part in us, the outer vital personality representative of the inner life being, the vital Purusha. What would really happen then is that the wall between the inner self and the outer man would have broken down, and the permanent mental and vital being from within, the mental and vital representatives of the immortal psychic entity, would govern the life. So it's a similar action that would occur for the vital. We're talking about the survival of the vital personality, pranamaya purusha. It isn't that vitality is ever killed. It is impossible to kill life. Life simply withdraws if it can't sustain itself in a physical being which can't support it endlessly. But it isn't necessary for the vital personality to be dissolved if it is sufficiently identified with the soul, just as the mind can identify with the soul. Both mind and life can exist perpetually in their inner parts as inner presentations in guise of personality of the soul force. Our mind nature and our life nature could then be a continuous progressive expression of the soul and not a nexus of successive formations preserved only in their essence. Our mental personality and life personality would then subsist without dissolution from birth to birth. They would be, in this sense, immortal, persistently surviving, continuous in their sense of identity. This would be evidently an immense victory of soul and mind and life over the inconscience and the limitations of material nature. So, he hasn't said that what is done by a personality in a life is wiped away forever. It's just that they are preserved only in their essence. Here, we have the active continuance as a possibility. If they can be stabilized in the psychic glow, if they can be identified with the soul force, then those parts of our subtle subliminal nature, mind and life, can go forward. Is it possible for the body? He takes us up next. But such a survival could only persist in the subtle body. The being would still have to discard its physical form, pass to other worlds, and in its return, put on a new body. Subtle body, because that is the point of integration between Manomaya Purusha and Pranamaya Purusha. They would be connected there, you see. That would be the repository for them. So there is a collaboration of this essential mind, life, and soul, representing a great stride forward and established here in the subtle physical, the sukshma sharira. The awakened mental purusha and vital purusha, preserving the mind sheath and the life sheath of the subtle body, which are usually discarded, would return with them into a new birth and keep a vivid and sustained sense of a permanent being of mind and life constituted by the past and continuing into the present and future. But the basis of physical existence, the material body, could not be preserved even by this change. The physical being could only endure if by some means its physical causes of decay and disruption could be overcome, and at the same time it could be made so plastic and progressive in its structure and its functioning that it would answer to each change demanded of it by the progress of the inner person. It must be able to keep pace with the soul in its formation of self-expressive personality, its long unfolding of a secret spiritual divinity, and the slow transformation of the mental into the divine mental or spiritual existence. So we have a footnote. And he says, in reference to the physical causes of decay and disruption, even if science, physical science or occult science, were to discover the necessary conditions or means for an indefinite survival of the body, still, if the body could not adapt itself so as to become a fit instrument of expression for the inner growth, the soul would find some way to abandon it and pass on to a new incarnation. The material or physical causes of death are not its soul or its true cause. Its true inmost reason is the spiritual necessity for the evolution of a new being. So this is a deep understanding of what it means to dissolve the body, what we call death. There is a spiritual necessity involved in it. And only when we provide a spiritual solution to this riddle can we really dispense with death as a means for our passage to a more progressive vehicle. If the body is to survive immortally, it must be infinitely capable of expansion and growth. So now, the balance of the chapter. This consummation of a triple immortality, immortality of the nature, completing the essential immortality of the spirit, and the psychic survival of death, might be the crown of rebirth and a momentous indication of the conquest of the material in conscience and ignorance, even in the very foundation of the reign of matter. But the true immortality would still be the eternity of the spirit. The physical survival could only be relative, terminable at will, a temporal sign of the spirit's victory here over death and matter. So we come to the conclusion of this chapter. Next week, we begin the last six chapters of The Life Divine, all written freshly by Sri Aurobindo for this revised version to complete and extend his vision. Those are the six chapters, of course, upon which the mother so often commented, and I think two of the chapters she spent a great deal of time covering in their essence, in her talks with the children in the playground, starting in October of 1957. If my arithmetic is right, that's about 60 years ago. So this, to conclude our night, is a section from Savitri. This is from the Book of Fate, Book 6, Canto 2, The Way of Fate and the Problem of Pain. All rose from the silence. All goes back to its hush. Its somnolence founded the universe. Its obscure waking makes the world seem vain. Arisen from nothingness and towards nothingness turned, its dark and potent nescience was Earth's start. It is the waste stuff from which all was made. Into its deeps, creation can collapse. Its opposition clogs the march of the soul. It is the mother of our ignorance. He must call light into its dark abysms, else never can truth conquer matter's sleep and all earth look into the eyes of God. All things obscure, his knowledge must relume. All things perverse, his power must unknot. He must pass to the other shore of falsehood's sea. He must enter the world's dark to bring there light. The heart of evil must be bared to his eyes. He must learn its cosmic dark necessity, its right and its dire roots in nature's soil. He must know the thought that moves the demon act and justifies the Titan's erring pride and the falsehood lurking in Earth's crooked dreams. He must enter the eternity of night and know God's darkness as he knows his sun. For this, he must go down into the pit. For this, he must invade the dolorous vasts. Imperishable and wise and infinite, he still must travel hell, the world to save. Into the eternal light he shall emerge on borders of the meeting of all worlds. There, on the verge of nature's summit steps, the secret law of each thing is fulfilled. All contraries heal their long dissidence. There meet and clasp the eternal opposites. There pain becomes a violent, fiery joy. Evil turns back to its original good, and sorrow lies upon the breasts of bliss. She has learned to weep glad tears of happiness. Her gaze is charged with a wistful ecstasy. Then shall be ended here the law of pain. Earth shall be made a home of heaven's light. A seer, heaven-born, shall lodge in human breasts. The superconscient beam shall touch men's eyes, and the truth-conscious world come down to earth, invading matter with the spirit's ray, awaking its silence to immortal thoughts, awaking the dumb heart to the living word. This mortal life shall house eternity's bliss, the body's self taste immortality. Then shall the world redeemer's task be done. Namaste. Jai Ma.